I think in the future it's going to be very difficult for rural areas to perhaps be represented.
Reaction to the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, another Supreme Court decision changes the Indian Child Welfare Act.
The court was focusing on the father, but the Indian Child Welfare Act, as its name suggests, is focusing on the Indian child and the Indian child's welfare.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The U.S. Supreme Court vacated a major provision of the landmark Voting Rights Act this morning. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the court did not invalidate the entire law, and Alaska's congressional delegation has mixed reactions.
Congress ratified the 13th and 14th Amendments in the shadow of the Civil War. The 13th outlaws slavery, and the 14th ensures equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment is the umbrella for Lyndon Johnson's crowning achievement, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of that bill requires 9 states, mostly in the South but also Alaska, to get approval from the Department of Justice before changing any election laws. The court left that intact, but deemed Section 4 unconstitutional. That section requires Congress to determine which states need preclearance. Preclearance could be needed for large decisions like district lines, all the way down to the makeup of the local school board. Section 4 dictates which states need to follow Section 5.
I'm thinking through what the next step is.
Senator Tim Kaine is a Democrat from Virginia. He's a former governor of that state, one of the 9 required to get preclearance from the federal government. The court struck down Section 4, Kaine says, because the most recent authorization of the act relied on outdated information.
In the 2006 reauthorization, just relying on the 65 map was not sufficient. You had to talk about the current, evidence and whether there was patterns of racial discrimination in the jurisdictions or not.
Democrats are pouncing on the issue as a political opportunity. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee started soliciting money soon after the ruling, warning of future attacks on voting rights. Senator Mark Begich, who's up for re-election in 2014, calls the ruling a setback for Alaska Natives and Bush communities. He says voter suppression still exists in Alaska.
You know, a couple of years ago, there was the last election cycle, some of the absentee voting booths were not allowed to be in certain areas.
Decades ago, the state forced natives to pass literacy tests to vote. That's since been abolished, and Senator Lisa Murkowski says Alaska has made improvements on voter suppression by making sure natives have access to interpreters.
We are getting to that point where we are seeing states work aggressively hard and in a fair and balanced way to ensure that the voting rights of all Americans are not disenfranchised.
Writing in the majority opinion, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts says voter discrimination still exists. That's why the law will remain on the books. And by invalidating Section 4, the ruling puts the onus on Congress to craft a new formula to determine which states need preclearance. Congressman Don Young says that's unlikely to happen.
There isn't much appetite right now because there's so many other things on the plate to really address the issue as it should be addressed.
While that may be the case in the Republican-controlled House, the Democratic-controlled Senate will jump at that chance. Already, Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy has said he'll hold hearings on a new formula for Section 4 next month. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Most states that had been covered under the Voting Rights Act won't feel the full impact of the Supreme Court's ruling until 2020, when the next redistricting cycle starts up. But Alaska, along with Texas, will experience the effects straight away. Here, political lines still haven't been finalized, and today's decision could shape the way boundaries are drawn. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Under federal law, Alaska was required to have 5 House and 3 Senate districts with large Native populations. The point was to guarantee Alaska Natives a voice in the legislature. With the Supreme Court striking down part of the Voting Rights Act, that requirement is gone.
What we fear is that it's going to be a net loss.
Alice Ruby is the mayor of Dillingham, where Alaska Natives make up over half the population. She says that even with the Voting Rights Act's requirements, communities like hers have seen their power diluted in recent years. As the population of cities along the rail belt has gone up, rural Alaska has seen its representation shrink. The number of Alaska Natives in office has also dropped, going from 7 to 5 in the last election cycle.
Well, and I don't know whether you define that as discrimination, but I do know it has affected certainly my community, because we ended up being part of either a district that was split in an odd way, or that the district was so large that our legislator really couldn't adequately represent us.
Ruby is nervous that things may get worse for her region. As a city official, she says the Supreme Court's ruling that all Alaska voting policies, whether they involve state or local elections, go through the Department of Justice before they get cleared, relieves some regulatory burdens on a municipality like hers. But she says that wasn't much of an inconvenience, and that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act largely benefited her region. With the Alaska Redistricting Board currently reviewing nearly a dozen political maps, she's worried that communities off the road system won't be adequately represented.
So why wouldn't we be afraid? The maps have been released and hearings are scheduled in the large urban areas, and here we are, still wondering what the impact will be on us.
Bob Brody serves on the Redistricting Board, and he says he understands those concerns.
I think in the future it's going to be very difficult for rural areas to perhaps be represented.
A number of the plans being reviewed by the board have a lot in common with the current map, which was drawn to meet Department of Justice standards. And the board's attorney says they're still keeping Native influence in mind. But when it comes to a decline in population, there's not much the board can do. Brody says this isn't just an Alaska problem.
I don't know so much if we could label it a Native thing, but it's certainly a rural thing that is common throughout across the country.
In addition to affecting redistricting, the Supreme Court's ruling could also have implications for future voting laws. A controversial bill that would require voters to display photo ID at polling places was introduced in the legislature earlier this year. And had it passed this session, the Department of Justice would have had to okay it before it would go into effect. Should the bill move forward next session, it would no longer have to go through that same review process. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez with help from Jay Barrett and Kodiak.
The U.S. Supreme Court released another decision today that has implications for tribes in Alaska. The Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, was enacted to stop American Indian and Alaska Native children from leaving their biological families and tribes when these children are being placed in foster care or up for adoption. ICWA mandates a preference for the Native child's family and tribe before non-Native placement can be considered. The Supreme Court's decision in this is in response to a case in South Carolina. The Native biological father has had his daughter since 2011 when she was 1 year old. But when she was born, the father was not around, and the non-Native mother attempted to allow a non-Native couple to adopt the child. In today's 5-4 decision, Judge Samuel Alito said because the father was not there at the beginning, he has no rights. Bert Hirsch is a Long Island attorney who helped write the ICWA legislation. It was 11 years before it passed in 1978. Hirsch says today's decision doesn't throw out the law, but in certain situations, it excludes Native family members.
It guts the intent of ICWA, in my opinion, with respect to the kind of case that is presented here, where you have a Native American parent who never had physical or legal custody, and in that circumstance, they're saying the Indian Child Welfare Act doesn't apply when that individual's parental rights are up for termination. The termination of that individual's parental rights is solely a matter of state law, is what they're saying. you know, if you go beyond that, remember the Indian Child Welfare Act applies to a myriad of different fact circumstances. There's just so many different fact variables that involve families and children that I would not say that I think it's going way overboard to say that the act is gutted. But I would say that this is damaging, and it does definitely exclude from coverage under the act a very significant type of person and circumstances that all of us who worked on the act and numerous courts that interpreted the act over all the last 35 some years all thought were covered under the act.
Describe what Congress would need to do to, in your mind, fix what the Supreme Court did that was damaging to ICWA today.
Well, with respect to this notion that the law only applies when to an unwed biological Indian father or Native American father when that father has had a pre-existing legal and or physical custody of the child, that would that language would have to be it would have to be made clear in that section of the law that Alito interpreted that that's not the case. That the mere fact of being the biological father of the child is sufficient to have the Indian Child Welfare Act apply, because the child is an Indian child and is a member of an Indian tribe. The court was focusing on the father. But the Indian Child Welfare Act, as its name suggests, is focusing on the Indian child and the Indian child's welfare. And the Congress was focused on the fact that the welfare, or the best interest of the child, if you will, of an Indian child, is to be placed in the custody of a tribal family whenever possible and to remain connected to the child's tribe whenever possible. That's what the Congress, as a national policy, has established as the welfare of an Indian child. That's what the Alito decision totally and completely ignores and loses sight of. And then the placement preference section would have to be made, would have to be changed as well to make it clear that Native American families who are preferred do not have to actually file a petition to adopt in an adversarial adoption proceeding before they can be considered to have their preference rights affirmed. That's not what the act was all about at all. That's so contrary to the law, to what the law intended. It's baffling how he could reach that conclusion.
Bird Hirsch is an attorney who helped write the ICWA legislation. He says in addition to focusing on the welfare or best interests of Indian children, ICWA also protects and preserves the very right of tribes to exist and survive. Keeping children within the tribe whenever possible was the means to accomplish this end. He says the court's decision ignores this. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Access Alaska gets new digs and new gear.
We have what's called a hub scrub, so it's like a dishwasher, big industrial dishwasher that fits a wheelchair or medical equipment.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
A former foster parent and daycare provider in Bethel has been arrested for charges that he sexually abused a four-year-old. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
A former foster parent and daycare provider in Bethel has been arrested for charges that he sexually abused a four-year-old. Bethel police arrested 69-year-old Peter Tony June 13th after investigating him for 6 months. They say he could have many more victims going back to the 1970s. Tony and his late wife, Marilyn, had been foster parents in Bethel for many years, but witnesses told police that allegations of abuse removed them from the program. Later, the Tonys opened a small daycare that Marilyn ran out of their home until a few years ago when she stopped because of health reasons. The dates when the Tonys were foster parents or when they became daycare providers are unknown. Immediate requests to the state for that information were denied. The Office of Children's Services is responsible for licensing foster homes in Alaska. Travis Erickson is the field administrator and says they can't talk about specific cases.
We have a lot of rules regarding confidentiality that we operate under.
The application process to become a foster parent in the first place is quite extensive, including background checks, says Carolee Peets, also with OCS.
Sex offender checks, court view, child protection checks. There's a variety of background checks that we do before a family would be able to be licensed as a foster care facility for the state of Alaska.
There are several serious reasons to have a license taken away, but no one at OCS could confirm whether the Tonys had or not. If they did, the public would not have been notified. Just the foster family itself, and for the kids, possible follow-up with child protection workers if it was a situation of neglect or abuse. Whatever reason the Tonys no longer did foster care, they later turned to a small in-home daycare. It's unlikely that it was licensed, as many in-home daycares in Bethel are not. It was not listed in records at the state's Child Care Program Office, which licenses daycares. What is known is that Tony allegedly abused a 4-year-old in Bethel for almost a year. The Bethel Police Department interviewed family, witnesses, and friends. Numerous potential victims have been identified both in Bethel and out of state. Police are asking anyone with information regarding the case to contact them. Tony was indicted by a grand jury in Bethel on 7 counts of sexual abuse of a minor and is being held on $100,000 bail. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Another person has been shot and killed by an Anchorage police officer. The shooting happened in the Fairview neighborhood of Anchorage last night. APD Police Chief Mark Mew says a lone officer pulled over a vehicle and the driver came at the officer with, quote, knife-like weapons.
Monday night, June 24th. At about 6:30 p.m., an officer stopped his patrol car on a vehicle in Fairview in the vicinity of 12th and Hyder and confronted a man there who was armed with a couple of weapons, which we are not describing in any detail today, but they were, you know, bladed weapons, and a shooting occurred. The person was struck and ultimately died at the hospital.
The man killed has been identified as 26-year-old Kenneth John. Several witnesses are being interviewed. An investigation is underway by the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals. There have been 5 APD officer-involved shootings so far this year, 3 of them fatal. Because of the increasing number of APD officer-involved shootings, the department's use of force policy is under review, and changes are expected later this year. The eruption at Pavlov Volcano on the Alaska Peninsula has picked up again. The volcano is spewing ash to 28,000 feet, the highest it's reached since the unrest started in early May. That's not high enough to interfere with international air traffic, but it does have communities in the region on alert. In the village of King Cove, there were reports of ash fall this morning, but resident Pam Mitchell says it wasn't particularly noticeable.
It's nothing like you see on TV. I mean, literally. It would be like if I aerosol sprayed something. Gritty. That's about it.
The increased activity also prompted Penn Air to cancel its flights into Cold Bay. Marketing Director Missy Anderson says it didn't impact the airline's other routes.
Cold Bay is typically used as our primary alternate for our Dutch and our Prib flights. But in this particular case, we were able to use our secondary, which is King Salmon. So those flights were still able to get to their final destinations.
The volcano isn't showing any signs of letting up. Dave Schneider is a geophysicist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He says seismic tremors at Pavlov started intensifying around midnight.
And that escalated over the next couple of hours to a pretty high level where it has continued. It sort of plateaued.
Pavlov is the most active volcano in Alaska and has previously erupted for weeks or even months at a time, although it typically cycles through periods of intense activity like the current one. President Barack Obama has declared a federal disaster for spring flooding in parts of Alaska. Governor Sean Parnell earlier this month requested the federal designation for the Alaska Gateway, Yukon Flats, Yukon Koyukuk, Lower Yukon, and Copper River areas, which include Galena and other communities affected by flooding in May and June. The president's declaration will make funding available for emergency work and repair of public infrastructure. The Federal Emergency Management Agency also says funding to share the cost of mitigating hazards also will be available. Individual assistance for temporary housing, home repairs, and other expenses will be available in all areas except the Copper River Regional Educational Attendance Area.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. Share your culture and create lifelong connections by welcoming an AFS International Exchange student into your home for a year, semester, or 6 to 12 weeks. Information at 1-800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by AFS USA.
More hot weather in the interior and the prospect of thunderstorms are likely to result in more wildfire activity. There are currently 86 active wildfires burning statewide. 14 of those are staffed. The Alaska Division of Forestry is monitoring two outside of Tok, and the Chisana River fire south of the Alaska Highway is now at about 30,000 acres. Also visible from the highway is the Billy Creek fire near Dot Lake. The 100-acre blaze was started by lightning over the weekend. The 20-acre Denison Fork fire, also lightning-caused, is burning near Chicken. The division is allowing both fires to burn naturally because there is little threat to life or property. This morning, Alaska State Troopers tried to stop a driver on Big Lake Road in the Mat-Su Valley's Big Lake area. The driver fled and the trooper pursued for 10 minutes before the man exited and allegedly fired at the trooper. The suspect then fled on foot. The trooper was not injured, called for backup to begin searching for the suspect. The search was called off just after 3 p.m., but troopers say the investigation is ongoing. The Department of Public Safety is advising local residents to remain cautious. A trooper spokeswoman says drivers are strongly encouraged not to pick up hitchhikers, and residents are encouraged not to answer the door for anyone except law enforcement officers or people they know personally. Access Alaska, a nonprofit that serves Alaska's seniors and people with disabilities, has a new building that will allow them to expand their mission. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The entryway to Access Alaska is open and airy with high ceilings and exposed pipe, giving it an industrial look that's contrasted by warm birchwood walls and soft earthy colors. Not what you'd expect from a building that's accessible to people with disabilities. Eric Spangler is the architect who redesigned the nondescript 1970s-era building in the Fairview neighborhood. He says he was tasked with showing that accessibility didn't have to mean ugly.
Access Alaska came to us with a mission that they didn't want this to look sterile or hospital-like.
Access Alaska moved into the new building this March, but contractors are just now putting on the finishing touches. Before this, the organization was renting in Midtown for more than a decade, making modifications as needed to accommodate workers and clients. In the new building, hallways are all extra wide so that people in wheelchairs and those walking can remain side by side. Pocket doors slide open under the pressure of just one finger, but it doesn't look institutional. Maya Strand is the interior designer for the project.
We really wanted to showcase it and highlight that that idea that incorporating above ADA standards is, it can be easily done and it looks fantastic.
In addition, all the furniture is height adjustable.
It was a very traditional clinic, long hallways with exam rooms coming and going on each, down the long hallways.
Kelly Miller is the executive assistant at Access Alaska. She says between Alaska's aging population and the return of combat veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, Access Alaska needed more space.
Some of our programs have grown exponentially between our personal care assistant program and also then our traumatic and acquired brain injury program are two that have grown that we needed more space.
The project cost about $3.5 million and was mostly paid for by grants from the Rasmussen Foundation and the Alaska Legislature. Access Alaska's main focus is helping seniors and people with disabilities to live independently. They also refurbish, repair, and sanitize used medical equipment, then loan it out for free. Miller adds that besides looking good, the office has a lot of critical, practical changes, like new equipment to better carry out their mission. She points to what looks like a giant silver washing machine.
One of the really interesting features that we have, I think we're the only one in the state, if not the Northwest, is we have what's called a hub scrub. So it's like a dishwasher, a big industrial dishwasher that fits a wheelchair or medical equipment. So that in this workshop here, equipment comes in the back door, it's dirty, it comes in here, it's sanitized in the big hub scrub, and then it's brought back out and provided back to the community.
With the redesign, the workshop has expanded to 3 times its original size. It was important that the offices be accessible, not just for clients, but for the people who work there. Because there's a focus on peer support, more than half of Access Alaska's employees have disabilities themselves. Frank Box is an independent living advocate who helps run the workshop that recycles used medical equipment. A welder by trade, Box has survived 2 bouts with brain cancer that left him unable to do his old job.
When I couldn't weld and fabricate anymore, I thought I was done. I thought that all of my experience was for naught. And it's not. It's all of my experiences in surviving brain cancer and 3 years off work while I went through rehabilitation gave me the skills to transfer what I already knew to help others.
Buck says he's proud of the new design and of working for an organization that's setting the bar for accessibility in the workplace in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Jeremy Scott in Galena, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Steve Heimel from Anchorage, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.